mother. I used to meet her at medical events, a startlingly pretty red-headed nurse. His father was a paediatrician, a lot older. Dad works late. Mum left a year ago. Anyway, the real thing is... So he hadn't told me the real thing yet. She'd started being sick sometimes.
Had she?
I hadn't noticed. In the mornings. I wouldn't have heard her vomiting upstairs in her bathroom, not from the kitchen, but I remember she'd stopped having breakfast. She had looked disgusted when I'd mentioned it, but she always ate supper, so I didn't worry. She fell asleep in class. The rehearsals were exhausting. I'd noticed she'd stopped running everywhere. So she did a test. There was a silence. Why had I never put it all together? Not eating in the morning, the tiredness, the emotional ups and downs. It was so obvious. Michael was watching me with concern. I got up and walked to the window. Naomi, pregnant? I couldn't make it feel remotely real. I turned to James. Do you know for certain? My voice sounded hard.
She did 3 tests altogether.
How many weeks?
We didn't know.
His white face turned away from my stare.
She thought she'd missed 2 periods, but she wasn't sure. 10, maybe?
Cottage tomorrow. Jay. 10 weeks.
Wait. What about the blood on the mattress? I looked at Michael, then back at James.
In the cottage, the weekend before the play began. When she went there with the man.
We thought she'd bled because it was her first time, but it can't have been her first time. She was already pregnant.
What man?
James looked puzzled.
It was me. Us. I thought Naomi told you that we went to the cottage. Afterwards, she bled, but she did another pregnancy test 3 days later. Last Tuesday, actually. And she was still pregnant. Bleeding a bit, but pregnant.
So it wasn't the man who had made her bleed after all. The man from the theatre. The bastard who had taken her. This made it worse. The man who had taken her now hadn't been the one to buy the wine. They hadn't shared anything. Not love. Of course not that. He didn't care. And suppose she was still bleeding, miscarrying and bleeding, or an ectopic. I looked at the tear-stained boy sitting at the table and felt a blazing fury.
What about you, James? What thoughts did you have about the pregnancy? What exactly was your plan?
I wanted whatever she wanted. I love her. I didn't really know what to do about the pregnancy.
I wanted to hit him. I wanted to kill him for making it more dangerous for Naomi. If you don't know what to do about a pregnancy, why the fuck didn't you use a condom?
He winced. Michael turned to me.
She was on the pill, he said quietly, but she sometimes forgot.
More secrets. How the hell was she on the pill? Did one of my friends prescribe it for her? You should bloody well have used a condom anyway, I shouted. You should have understood what you were doing. You've made it far worse.
I took a deep, shuddering breath.
What about the man she was seeing then? Did you know anything about him?
He lowered his head. There were tears in his voice.
I knew something had changed. It was soon after rehearsals began. I always used to walk her back home, but sometimes she didn't want me to. She said she wanted to practice on her own in the theatre, stuff like that. She wasn't the same. She stopped telling me everything.
Go on.
I hardly recognised my voice, it was so expressionless. I imagined it was like the voice that the blank-faced policewoman in the corridor must use when she talked to criminals.
I saw a man once. I was walking out of the changing room at the theatre, and I saw her talking to someone. I only saw him from behind. He was leaning against the wall, bending towards her. He had long, dark hair. Messy. I took it in because she was so kind of focused on him. She didn't see me, though I called out that I would wait outside. I waited for ages. Everyone left, and she still didn't come out. So I gave up.
He started crying, deep heaving sobs.
I should have gone back in. I should have looked at his face.
Michael got up. It's all right, James. You must be exhausted. I'll drive you home.
Wait.
I felt a pang of remorse and put my hand on the boy's arm to stop him getting up. She had stopped telling me everything as well. Look, James, you were careless, stupidly careless. But you loved her. I realised that. I saw the ring you gave her and...
You gave her that ring?
He looked at me blankly.
She said it had belonged to her granny. It was a family heirloom.
I stared at him. So she had lied to both of us. That man must have given it to her. Perhaps even when he was leaning up against the wall that time. He might have chosen that very moment to slip the ring on her finger, and that was why she was focused. She would have thought she meant something to him, and all the time it was a trick. James got to his feet. He was going to say sorry. I didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to feel pity for this boy, this child, who may have tipped the balance of Naomi's life. Wherever she was, pregnant, perhaps still bleeding, she was in even more danger than I had thought. Tell me... It was hard to ask what Naomi thought about being pregnant when I should have known. It's the kind of thing a daughter whispers to her mother, keeping it secret from everyone else. What were her plans about the baby? He looked at me. Though his eyes were puffy, it was obvious that the question puzzled him.
She didn't want it, of course.
His laugh was strained. She wanted a miscarriage, and she read somewhere that if we made love, that might make it happen. That's why she wanted to go to the cottage. She was really glad when she started bleeding. After he left with Michael, I sat down, my legs trembling. It was strange he should use those words. Make love. They hadn't been making anything. It had been the opposite. And the torn piece of yellow paper from a tampon I saw on the floor the night she went missing. She must have still been bleeding from the threatened miscarriage, not menstruating. Had she been in pain? By the time Michael returned, my mind was spinning with possibilities. He sat close to me at the table. My thoughts rushed into words. How do we know if anything James says is true? Perhaps he did give her the ring, as she said. How do we know if Naomi was pregnant, or even if she slept with him? Perhaps he never went to the cottage. He could be making this whole thing up. My hands were clenched on the table in front of us. I couldn't stop. Perhaps the other guy took her to the cottage, but James might be the one who's got her now. Think about it. He was jealous about Naomi talking to this man, so he's hurt her or hidden her somewhere. Michael briefly put his hand on mine. His fingers were blunt-ended and warm.
He was at the police station for hours, Jenny. He's telling the truth.
His voice was very certain.
They did go to the cottage that Saturday. A man walking by with his dog saw a red Volvo outside. It turns out they borrowed the car from James's father.
I closed my eyes. Michael's voice continued, listing all the evidence. I made myself listen.
James said they stopped at the motorway service station outside Taunton, so we're going through the CCTV tapes. We fingerprinted him last night, so they can see if the prints match ones on the bottle and the glasses.
He paused. I opened my eyes and looked at him as he continued quietly.
I've also spoken to Nikita. She knew Naomi was pregnant.
They haven't got secrets. They're not little kids.
Shan's voice had sounded angrily certain, but did she really believe what she had told me?
What else?
I got up and walked around the kitchen again. What else does Nikita know? Did she say if she knew Naomi had planned to leave? The questions tumbled out.
What was she going to do about the pregnancy?
She knew Naomi had met someone else she liked, and that she was due to meet him the night she disappeared.
But Naomi hadn't told her anything about him. Nikita doesn't think she planned to go for good. She thinks she would have said something to her, some kind of goodbye. Michael looked at me briefly.
She knew Naomi wanted to end the pregnancy, that she was worried. Of course, there was the diary and the reference at the end to 10 weeks. She would have told herself a 10-week pregnancy wasn't far enough advanced to matter. She wouldn't know that tiny nails were forming on the fingers and toes. That's the kind of information no one wants if they have to do what Naomi was planning.
All right.
I put my hands to my head, as if to hold the racing thoughts still.
Let's say it happened exactly as James said and they went to the cottage. How do we know he didn't take her himself that night? Perhaps he waited secretly for everyone to leave after the play and then took her somewhere.
His father was there that night to watch him in the play. James was Chino, remember? They went out for a meal at Hotel Duvin afterwards. We checked there last night and the staff remembered them. They showed me a copy of the bill. Michael had been thorough. I was silent. I had wanted it to be James, hiding Naomi because he was jealous, because he loved her, and he wanted to keep her safely his. Will it make a difference to how he treats her, whoever he is? Will he treat her better if he knows she's pregnant? Michael didn't answer, but I knew anyway. She would be a nuisance with the vomiting and the bleeding. In time, if he gave her time and if she didn't miscarry, she would become conspicuous.
Let's deal with what we have.
Michael's calm voice stopped my train of thought.
We have a bit of photo fit for the prime suspect, from what Mrs. Mears, Nikita and James have said, and that's going on all the lampposts in the area around here, along with a photo of Naomi's face. We are continuing to watch ports and airports, and we are starting a house-to-house inquiry today.
Why? He probably didn't live anywhere near here.
It seemed so random, so useless. She could be miles away. A tiny hut in Scotland, a garage in Wales. We didn't even know what he looked like, though my mind played with the new information. He was older, he had long, messy hair. He was different from the boys she knew. Was he attractive just because he was so different?
Remember, we have to look at all possibilities at the same time.
He had said that before. What sort of possibilities? He stood and dug his hands into his pockets. This must be difficult. His grey eyes looked strained with effort. In the seconds he took to answer, some detached part of my mind wondered what he would look like if he smiled, really smiled. What did his wife feel about the times his job stole him away? Did she mind? Would she worry? She might have got used to it, as I had with Ted. She would tell herself he was deeply committed to his job.
Well, it seems likely she did arrange to meet this man, but it is possible he might not have turned up. In that case, she might have begun walking home.
I'd imagined this already. The theatre was a few minutes away, and although we'd always asked her to call if it was dark, she might not have wanted to bother us. Her spiky shoes tapping the pavement would be loud in the silent street, so she wouldn't have noticed the quiet thud of following footsteps until they were very near.
We are going to interview the father of the little girl you told us about. You thought he might want revenge.
It can't be him. He's a father.
For some reason, my eyes filled with tears.
He loves his daughter too much to hurt somebody else's child.
But perhaps it doesn't work like that. Perhaps there are no rules. I walked to the window and looked up into the street. The white vans were closed now. The men with cameras must have been inside, perhaps somewhere else, watching the house out of sight. Other people were coming and going along the pavements. Cars were driving up and down. The man who had taken our daughter could be someone I knew, or a man on the periphery of our lives whom I had never noticed. It could be anyone, anyone in the world. Perhaps that man over there, I thought. The one who is smiling to himself as he crosses the road. Perhaps he has Naomi somewhere, locked up and helpless. Why is he smiling? I wanted to run out, shout questions in his face, see if he looked guilty. I looked at Michael.
How am I supposed to do this?
His hand reached out again, and he grasped my wrist tightly.
Tell me what to do, Michael!
I kept still. I needed the strength I could feel in his hand.
Step by step is how you do it.
His eyes travelled over my face.
You have to look after yourself,
That's the first step. Eat something. Wash your hair. He smiled at me. I didn't tell you before because I didn't want you to worry about it, but the appeal on television is scheduled for tomorrow morning. We'll need to prepare a statement. Can you let Ted know? By the time Ted came home, I'd had a bath. I had even tried on a suit for tomorrow's appeal, though I'd had to roll the skirt top over to make it stay on my waist. My hair was wrapped in a towel. I was trying to eat a sandwich. I told him James and Michael had been here, and then, sitting close to him, holding his hand, I told him that Naomi was pregnant. He shook me off, got to his feet, outraged and unbelieving. He thought at first James must be lying. I told him everything James had said, and what Michael had told me as well, and the way in which fragments of her diary now made sense. Ted began to pace around the kitchen. I thought he was going to break something. Underneath his seething anger, I felt a bitter backwash of feeling break against me. He must be thinking that as her mother, I should have known she was pregnant, even though she kept it secret. Perhaps he was right. When he was sitting down again, his face white and closed, I put my hand on his clenched fist. "Don't let this destroy us, Ted." He looked at me blankly. I don't think he heard what I was saying. 18. Dorset, 2010. 12 months later. Mid-December. The year has deepened. Every day the light becomes quieter. From high up on Egerton Hill, the little fields below us tilt to the coast. The slivers of sea in the distance are white as frost. The only noises in the silent countryside are my footsteps and Bertie's crunching through the icy turf. Bridport sits in a valley near the sea. Its wide streets are busy at this time of year. The old stone buildings stand plainly to the road, and despite the garish lights strung about them, they look as they always do, as they must have done 200 years ago. The bookshop door jangles open, but instead of the usual book-scented peace, the narrow spaces are jammed with people. There is a smell of wet hair and banana bubblegum. A broad woman with a disgruntled face steps on my toes and glances angrily at me, while a child nearby pulls books from a shelf and throws them on the floor. Naomi's books were easy to choose. She loved so many different authors: Lawrence, Kerouac, Mark Haddon, Stieg Larsson. Faced with the crowd in the bookshop, I collect an armful of novels for the boys and put them in a basket. My fingers linger on the spines of other books as I try to remember what Ted had on his bedside table a year ago. The novels I had chosen for him had always remained pristine under a thin layer of dust. Perhaps I never knew what he liked. I buy the books I have collected and leave, crossing the road under the clock tower as it strikes 11. In Boots, I choose Ted a leather wash bag and collect together toothbrush, toothpaste, flannel and soap, then wait in a jostling line to pay. A smear of pink glitters peripherally. Turning my head, I see those little pots and tubes of makeup and shampoo that I used to put in her stocking, along with spotted knickers, bracelets, tangerines, joke biscuits made of plastic. It had been fun. I'd forgotten that. That world where fun was an end in itself had vanished with her. The games and silly jokes she played on the boys, the fuss at birthdays and Christmas, which they scorned but joined in, all that went when she did. No, of course it went before then. I stop in the queue as that thought catches me again, and two girls behind bump into me, mutter and laugh. The fun had stopped long before. I hadn't noticed exactly when. It had been gradual. I'd been busy. Even on the summer holiday before the autumn term began, she'd been quieter. At the till, I snap back to myself, pay, and then awkwardly gather the bags that are round my feet. At least this year I have bought presents. Last year I tried, but I couldn't. Naomi had been gone just over a month. There were teenage girls and their mothers everywhere,
choosing decorations, picking out little gifts, calling to each other for approval. I remember I'd had to leave my full basket on the floor in a shop and walk out in tears through the pushing crowds. Now, going towards the car park, I can just about bear to see the families inside these crowds. I see this mother, that child. Now I can watch them, though I couldn't before. Once the shopping is loaded in the car, I drive home along the narrow lanes, past the golf course glimpsed through the tattered winter hedge and the empty donkey field. The field beyond this has rows of empty caravans and a boarded-up shop, dismal in the dull light. Then the first little brick bungalows of the village. I know them so well I hardly see them. That was what happened with Naomi too. I stopped seeing her because I knew her by heart. I drive slowly past the church and up my lane. As I bring the shopping in from the car and dump everything on the floor, Bertie noses at the unfamiliar mass of plastic bags. In the kitchen, the light suddenly darkens. Someone has followed me to the doorway. I swing round, catching my head on the corner of the open cupboard, tearing the scar that formed after my fall into the tree. It throbs immediately, and the blood wells. I recognize his shoulders against the light before I see his face.
Michael!
I am surprised by how glad I feel, but as I move towards him, my hands feel weak with sudden dread. What has he come to tell me? The tomatoes drop, and the foil-wrapped Christmas pudding rolls under the table. Bertie runs to investigate and pats it further away with his paw.
What's happened, Michael? Say quickly!
Nothing. Nothing's happened. He spreads his arms wide, opens his hands to show they are empty, no secrets. I was passing.
Passing?
No one ever passes Burton Bradstock.
I'm on my way to Devon to see my folks. Christmas, remember?
Then his face changes, his eyebrows draw together. You're bleeding. You cut your head. He pulls a white handkerchief from his pocket, and his hands are careful as he presses the wound through the soft linen. Close up, I catch that familiar, freshly laundered scent, mixed with toothpaste. His mouth, inches from my eyes, is unguarded. My skin tingles with the surprise of touch, and I am completely still. I feel him registering that. As his hands drop lightly to my shoulders, he looks down at me. It's stopped bleeding now. He pauses.
You look well.
His eyes are warm as he takes in my face.
I've wondered.
And he reaches for the right words. I step back.
It's good to see you again. Sorry to greet you like a death's head.
We stare at each other. He is taken aback by my words. He looks down, and I can see how the brightness in my tone has jarred. What had he imagined would happen when we met? That brief kiss months ago in the kitchen in Bristol had come from a moment of exhaustion. My guard had been down, a mistake, nothing more. Coffee? I turn, hands hovering over the mugs, waiting for the moment to pass.
Yes, and no. I thought we might go for a walk. I'll buy you lunch. When I was driving into the village, I saw signs to a restaurant on the beach.
I pick up the dropped food and push it into the fridge, then put Bertie on his lead. I check quickly in the mirror. He said I looked well. How is that possible? My hair is a wild black tangle, and I never wear makeup now, but my eyes are blue against skin turned brown from walking by the sea. The fresh air and simple food have made my face recover. The mirror gives me back my curious glance, as though I am looking at someone whose face I recognize but can't quite place. We go out together through the garden gate into the field. I've thought of you down here so often, he says, turning to me, smiling slightly. It looks completely different from how I imagined it. Did he think there would still be blood on the floor and dirty wine glasses? Desiccated flies on the windowsill? Are you all right, mostly? His voice is careful. He wants to know, but isn't sure how to ask. Am I all right? As we walk through the field,
then cross the road to the beach path. I think of the evenings in front of the fire, sketching my thoughts. The stack of paintings behind the chair getting thicker. Dan calls in after school sometimes to help with odd jobs. He's painted a room for me. We've become friends, though we don't talk much. I look forward to his company. He reminds me of my boys. There are cups of tea with Mary, and I've been to the library with her twice now. Theo phones from time to time, and I visit Ed. Ted sends the occasional postcard or text when he leaves the country for meetings. But there is never a moment without pain at the back of it. Her face is everywhere. Sometimes the need to know what happened is stronger than I can bear. When I first came to the cottage, I would stand on the pebbles with the icy water frothing around my legs, holding Bertie to stop me walking into the sea. All right doesn't quite... It's less than that, but...
Tell me.
And then we are talking. At least I am. He is listening. I am talking and crying. It feels dangerous to let the words flow unchecked, but I can't seem to stop. The despair and loneliness of these last 4 months flood through me, and he puts his arm round me. He lets me tell him everything, until I feel emptied out and the tears have stopped. We walk up and down the beach, while the wind catches the edges of the pounding waves, tears off bits of foam and blows them at us. The Beach Hut Cafe is open. I haven't been inside for years, not since the children were small, when we would come in for fish and chips. In the summer there are noisy crowds eating out under a new awning, but today it's quiet. A few of the tables are occupied by old men reading the Dorchester Chronicle, dogs by their feet. The place smells of tea and wet dog. Michael orders fish and chips for us, and within minutes we are given fresh slices of flaky haddock and piles of hot, salty chips on thick white plates. We take them to a table by the window. I rub a clear patch on the steamy glass and watch the breaking waves crash on the empty beach. My eyes feel sore with crying, but I've let something go, and I feel better. It's good to be here with Michael. With the sea outside, it reminds me of being on a boat. No one can reach us. Different rules could apply. Michael says quietly that he's been promoted at work, and then, looking outside, tells me that his wife left him 6 months ago. I feel guilty. He has listened to me for so long.
You never said. I'm sorry.
Should I have? Should I have let you know? He looks at me, and I look away quickly. A year ago, we had reached for each other one night in the kitchen in Bristol. Ted had gone to bed without a word. Michael had come by on the way home. I was tired and tearful, angry with Ted for being able to retreat into sleep. Michael's kindness had been something to hold on to. Michael is looking out of the window again. The clouds are reflected in the grey of his eyes. The words come slowly. We married young. He stops, shrugs.
I don't want to bore you with my stuff.
Tell me what happened.
I don't talk about it much. It's over now.
Tell me. He hesitates a moment longer.
We got married at 18 in Cape Town. She was pregnant. She miscarried after a few weeks.
I should be able to hear these words, pregnant and miscarrying, by now, without an answering sharp stab of pain. Naomi's child would be nearly 6 months old. I count the months as they go by. If the pregnancy had continued and the baby survived, if she had... I clench my teeth together as the anguish washes over me, then recedes a little. Michael hasn't noticed. He has carried on.
So I thought England might be different, with less pressure from our families, better medical advice. But she didn't get pregnant again.
He looks at his hands, then back at me.
I had to make a career, but the hours were long. It was hard for her. She was so alone.
I know how it would have been. By 10 at night, she would scrape his waiting supper into the bin. Another night she might arrange something, a cinema outing or a play, and sit ready, waiting with her coat on at home until after the performance had begun. Then she would sit on, simply holding the white envelope with the tickets inside. Days on her own, though the nights would be worse. Every month she would cry when her period came. Michael continues. She started volunteering for the Citizens Advice Bureau, then she got pregnant, and this time she didn't lose it. So, you do have a child? His eyes are so serious that I falter. Was it a boy or... A boy. Not mine. The father is a lawyer she met in the bureau. Married, but he's left his wife. He pauses. We should never have got married in the first place. How could he have known, though? How could I? When you are young, you have no idea what you will need as time passes, or how strong you might have to be. Don't look so worried, he smiles. It's history now. I'm sorry I took advantage. He's sorry to let himself say anything. Or maybe he's thinking back to the evening in the kitchen a year ago. I think myself back there, too. His hand had been warm on my back. His mouth had held mine. After all, it had had the rough edge of something real when nothing else had. Outside, the air has darkened. White surf glows through the rain. The waves further back have merged with the mauve of early evening and have become invisible. It's colder than before, but the food and talking have warmed me. We walk back over the fields, hands bumping. Inside the cottage, I feed Bertie. Michael makes the fire. It pulls at my heart to see him here now, quietly making my fire, bending seriously to the task. The kindling catches and flares. Then he turns to me. I walk into his arms, and we begin kissing as though we had never stopped. It is like the heat of sun when it's been cold and dark for a long time. He leads me to the fire and takes off my coat, takes his off. We undress in the dark. He pulls the thick blanket from its place on the sofa and covers us both. We lie together, touching along the length of our bodies. His skin feels familiar and new at the same time, safe and dangerous. He has sensed my unease, and pulling slightly away, he strokes my face by firelight. What is it? He asks softly. Tell me. How will this work? Are you allowed to do this? I mean... Don't worry. I can hear the smile in his voice. It's our secret. Our secret? Should we have one? His arms are close round me, comforting, and my unease dissolves. His hands move slowly over me, and as my skin begins to heat, I turn into him, pulled in by the warmth, wanting this now. Into my mind comes the thought that Naomi did this too. She must have been pulled into something secret before it changed into something dangerous. Then his mouth covers mine, and we begin to move together, as though we have been waiting for this for a long time. Bristol, 2009. 5 days after.
I'm sorry.
Michael looked stricken. His hand dropped to his side. It's okay. I felt too tired for this. I could hear the impatience edging my voice. Don't look so guilty. It doesn't matter. I didn't want this to make any difference, because we still had to work together. We were in the kitchen. Ted was upstairs. After the television appeal in the morning, he had gone straight to work. He had been there all day. He said it grounded him to carry on. It worked for him, but for me there was no ground. It had ceased to exist. I lived in a black space across which I saw him distantly. I felt sorry and angry from far away. I couldn't understand how he could go out, greet patients and colleagues. When he came back, he ate quickly, standing up, then went to bed, grey with exhaustion. Michael had called in late. The boys had already gone to bed.
I was telling Michael how worried I was for the boys, when I had started crying. He had put his arm round me, we had moved closer, he had bent his head to mine, and then, for a second, our mouths had met. I'd pulled back, it had felt instantly wrong. I was exhausted, and he must have been too. A momentary reflex, that's all, created out of despair and loneliness. No one was to blame. I went to see Jade again today, I said quickly, hoping this would help us get back to where we had been. It seemed to work. As I talked, I could see him settling into himself again, taking charge. I'd promised I would. I thought people would stare at me because my eyelids were so puffed up, but no one took any notice. I realized as I spoke that when I had worked in hospital, I had ignored them too, the army of the grief-stricken sleepless who sat invisibly in the wards, watching and waiting. Her father was with her. He stood up when I got there. He's big. I'd forgotten. Why didn't you call me? Michael asked. I heard annoyance in his voice. I could have come with you. It might have helped. I'm supposed to be supporting you. It's my job, remember? I wouldn't have expected you to come along. It was my mistake, I told him. I'd got the diagnosis wrong. I had to sort it out. How did it go? I took her some old books of Naomi's and she thanked me. She seemed glad to see me. She was fatter. The chemotherapy contained steroids, so it's an artificial sort of fatness, but she looked better all the same. I could feel the tears spilling out again. But the most difficult thing was what happened with Jeff Price. What did he do? Michael sounded angry. Nothing. He said sorry.
What?
I thought back to the moment Jade had taken the books and opened one.
Whose writing is that?
She had turned to her father, showing him the pencil marks scrawled across the sky on the first page.
Naomi Malcolm, he read. My bed, my bedroom, number 1, Clifton Road, Bristol, England, the world, the universe, outer space.
He paused, then added,
That's the doctor's little girl, Jadey.
Won't she mind?
Jade turned her face towards me. No, I said. I had forgotten about the writing. She's bigger now. I tried to smile. Perhaps Jade read my expression.
I'll give it back when I've finished, she said.
I nodded, unable to speak. Jeff Price walked down the aisle of beds with me. Children were lying in hot little heaps on their beds, faces flushed and stupefied with boredom. They were as silent as ill animals, swamped by layers of relatives who sat around them, watching television. He stopped in the corridor outside the plastic doors of the ward.
I saw you on the telly earlier. I'm sorry about what's happened. Not right. I know we had words, but that's not right.
Thanks. I paused. The police are interviewing everyone, even my patients.
Fine by me. Bring it on. Anything I can do to help. I've been here 24/7, the nurses will tell them that.
He touched me on the shoulder and walked back, seeming to fill the corridor as he went, lurching slightly from side to side, his feet in their huge white trainers sucking noisily at the shiny blue floor. The plastic doors had slapped shut behind him. Michael was waiting patiently for my response. Jeff Price was sorry about Naomi, I told him again. Perhaps you don't need to interview him after all.
Well, it shouldn't take long.
It didn't seem as if I could stop what I'd started, even if I was sure Jeff Price wasn't involved.
You were great on television,
Michael smiled, changing the subject. The lights had been hot and bright. They had made my eyes water, but I didn't want people to think I was crying. I didn't want Naomi's abductor to know what he was doing to us. We were warned that if you show your distress, it can make things worse. Parents become victims to be manipulated. At the same time, we had to do it. We had to reach out to the woman who might have glimpsed her blurred face in a car window in an unknown city and seen her open mouth calling for help. We had to grab the attention of the man serving in a corner shop,
who might have noticed that the quiet bloke who normally just bought cigarettes was now buying extra things, food, tape, sanitary towels for the bleeding. We had to tell the child on a bike ride to pick up the grey hoodie that was caught at the bottom of a hedge down a country lane, the one she had thrown out so someone would find it. I wanted the woman by the lights, the shopkeeper, and the child on the bike to be on my side.
"You were really great," Michael said again when I didn't reply. "So was Ted. We'll need to see him again, by the way."
"I think he's asleep now. It's funny. He can hardly seem to keep awake, but I can't sleep at all."
"Just a few questions. Tomorrow would be better."
"I can probably answer them now."
"No. We need to ask him the questions."
He sounded serious, almost regretful. I didn't understand.
"What questions?"
"Not everything is adding up. We need to straighten a few things out."
I felt sick. Did we have to go over it all again, separately? Did this mean the police had decided not to believe what we were saying?
"Michael, please! Time is going by and every second..."
"That's why we've got to get this straight. Could you tell him he needs to be at the station in the morning? We'll collect him."
It sounded so ridiculous, like some television police drama where the husband is needed for questioning and the wife becomes hysterical. "If I can answer for him, it will save a lot of time."
Michael sighed quickly. "All right. Do you happen to know where Ted was the night Naomi went missing?"
I got up and started walking around the kitchen, picking up the glasses and cups that seemed to litter every surface. They knew the answer to that already. I was tired. I wanted to go to bed now. "I know exactly where he was, at the hospital. His operation was running late. He had a difficult case. It happens all the time."
"If anyone doesn't believe that, it's easy enough to check with the theatre staff at the hospital."
Michael stood up as well. His face was expressionless, and it was as though he hadn't heard me.
"I'll let myself out," he said,
and his voice sounded oddly formal.
"Please tell him he'll be collected in the morning."
Once he'd left, I sat at the table, my eyes closed. Michael's words seemed to echo on in the silence. After a while, I went to the phone and rang the hospital. I asked to be put through to Neuro Theatres. Though it was late, a male theatre assistant answered immediately. He sounded very young. I told him who I was, and that Ted had asked me to check on the time he'd started in theatre the previous Thursday evening. He had forgotten to record the length of the operation and needed it for a GP letter. The words came so smoothly, it was as if I'd been rehearsing them rather than plucking them from the tumult in my mind. He left for a moment, then returned.
"Sorry to keep you waiting, Dr. Malcolm. Had to double check. Sure you didn't mean Monday?"
"I'm certain he said Thursday," I replied, my heart thudding.
"It's just that it was only Mr. Patel in Neuro Theatre on Thursday. Mr. Malcolm's case was cancelled. I can find out how long the operation took on the Monday if you want to phone me back."
"He'll be in touch if he needs to." I replaced the receiver and then went upstairs and sat on a chair next to my sleeping husband. I stared at him for so long that his face changed and seemed to dissolve, in the way that your own identity does if you say your name over and over to yourself. In the end, he looked like any man lying there, a stranger who I happened to have met by accident.
19. Dorset, 2010. 13 months later. A group of small children sing Christmas carols at the entrance to Dorchester Station, huddling round a grey-haired woman at their centre. The children are restless in their downward-slipping Santa hats, two are stamping on each other's toes, and the smallest girl wipes her running nose with her sleeve. The woman resolutely conducts the singing, but her sharply moving hands look as if she is painting punishments in the air. Away in a manger spirals thinly outwards as I walk towards the barriers to Platform 1. There is something familiar in the way this woman is driving herself to play her part. She stands so upright, her voice is too cheerful.
She belongs to a world I used to be part of, and as I look at her, I remember its weight. There are no duties now to push me through the day. Life is stripped down, and my roles are simpler, mother, not wife. If I'd had to put my occupation on a form, I'd write painter. Ed's train is due. Sophie is coming with him. They didn't need him to stay for Christmas in the unit after all. It only occurs to me now, too late, that a train journey could be difficult for him, with all the noise and crowds, after the routine and order of his days in the unit. In a few minutes, the train rushes in, doors slide open, and then there are streams of moving heads to scan. So it's a jolt when his arms come round from behind to encircle my waist tightly.
Ed!
He is laughing. Laughing! I haven't seen Ed even smile for months. I needn't have worried. His face is unshaven, his brown eyes deeply alive, his long black hair shining. He has a rucksack, and his guitar is slung across him. He turns, puts his arms round a girl almost hiding behind him.
Mum, this is Sophie. Soph, Mum.
Her colours light up the drab station. Short, bright red hair, green eyes circled with grey coal, a green knitted coat, stripy blue gloves, orange hat, yellow boots. There is a silver ring through one nostril. She is carrying an accordion strapped to her back. Her face is watchful, calm, and very pretty. I take one of her gloved hands in mine.
Hello, Sophie.
She smiles.
Hi.
So lucky she could come, Ed says, looking at her. She nearly couldn't. Jake wanted her to be there for Christmas lunch on the boat, but in the end it was all right.
I smile at Sophie.
Thanks for having me.
Her chin tilts a little as she says this. There is a soft Irish lilt to her voice. In the car on the way back, Sophie sits close to Ed, and he points out the cliffs and beaches as we pass. I tell him Theo is arriving later with Sam, the partner we haven't yet met. Then he wants to know what time Ted is expected. Tomorrow or the next day. He's flying back from Johannesburg today.
I reckon he's really on holiday, Ed says, shrugging.
I thought he kept in touch with Ed. So, nothing's changed. He's been busy all their lives, birthdays, parents' evenings, sometimes Christmas and holidays. The burden of responsibility settles down on me again. It feels as heavy as it did during all those years when I thought he was sharing it. Ironically, it got lighter after he left, or perhaps I just knew to brace myself. Why then does the disappointment burn now?
Not on holiday. I told you, he's been at a meeting.
Typical.
I check in the driving mirror, but he's smiling again. There is even a slight air of pride as he slips an arm round Sophie. My father, busy and important.
Good for your dad. I've always wanted to work in Africa, she says.
It's only a conference, I tell her. For a couple of weeks. His real job is in Bristol.
Sophie works for Amnesty International, Ed says.
That's impressive. I look at her face in the mirror. She smiles and shrugs.
I just translate stuff, French and German.
She and Jake can talk to each other in any language, especially if they want to say something about me they know I won't understand, Ed says matter-of-factly.
You wouldn't understand about you whatever language we spoke in. Would-be medics don't get themselves. Too busy being heroes in their own drama.
Her lilting voice is amused. They both laugh as if it's an old joke. In the weeks after his admission to the unit, we had skated around what he might do when he left. He never mentioned doing medicine again after he'd had to leave school. He did his A-levels in the unit, and when his spectacular results came through, it only added to the grief, the sense of what might have been. He told me he's happy to stay on helping out for now. This isn't the moment to talk about plans. He seems as if he is fresh from a holiday.
Bertie is standing in the hall when I open the door. Ed's face crumples. He kneels down, puts his arms round the dog and starts to cry. Bertie stands still, blinking. He sneezes once and then sniffs Ed's hair, tail wagging. Sophie kneels next to Ed and hugs him, laying her cheek next to his. I make tea.
I should have seen this coming and prepared him in some way for how the past melts into the present. After a few minutes, Ed gets up, blows his nose, and laughs shakily.
Sorry, Bert.
He bends and puts his hand on Bertie's head again.
Shall we go to the sea now and take Bertie? Sophie asks.
Ed nods and they drink their tea. Then they all go out to the fields, through the garden. I watch him pause at the gate, touch the post. I wonder for the 100th time whether he has yet found a place to put everything that has happened, to keep it until he can think about it and try to make sense of it. I watch them cross the field. Then it's time to take the chicken out of the fridge, slide butter and herbs under the skin, and put lemon and garlic inside. When it's in the oven, I pour a glass of wine and take it to the wooden shed outside that I cleared for a studio a week ago, knowing there wouldn't be room in the house. With the windows clean, the light had poured through. The old leaves and dust and mouse droppings were swept away. There was a trestle table in there already. I bought a new heater and hung some of my paintings from the nails in the wall. My oil painting of Mary's hands is on the table. They look like claws, the fingers deformed by rheumatism, the skin shiny and puffed. She calls them her witch hands, but they make tea, hold eggs and garden tools, bake bread. I've painted them loosely open for her kindness. If Mary is a witch, she is a good witch. Dan's hands are holding a piece of wood. They look careful and careless at the same time. The wood tilts out of his fingers, but he's trapped it with his thumb so that the holding and letting go are balanced. And there is a very new pencil sketch of Michael's hand. Last weekend he was sitting in here, in an old deck chair near the window. He was reading and resting his hand on his knee. The sketch has captured the power of his fingers and the width of his hand. It needs finishing. I find my pencil, and as I work, a few flakes of snow fall outside the window. I shade the marked curve of the muscles of the ball of his thumb, and it's as though he's touching me. I close my eyes, remembering the feel of his hands on my body. Naomi's eyes, as they are in the portrait, shine at me behind my eyelids. Secrets are dangerous. She should have been careful. Should I be, of Michael? Ed and Sophie come back. Their clothes are flecked with snow.
I've never seen the beach in winter, Ed says as he strips off his wet coat. It was so empty.
Sophie's teeth are chattering.
The cliffs were amazing. All those layers.
They go to bathe and shower, and later, after the chicken, after wine and coffee and washing up, they sit near the fire and Sophie plays her accordion. Ed joins in with his guitar. They look comfortable. This must be something they do often. I join them at a little distance, half in the shadows, sitting in my father's blue chair near the door.
Who are we going to dedicate this to, then?
Sophie asks. Dad.
Tell me about him,
Sophie says sleepily. She lets her arms rest and her fingers stop playing.
I told you, he's a neurosurgeon, Ed replies. He operates on people's heads, you know, fixes their brains.
I feel sad at this pride in his voice. Does Ted have any idea? Would he care? 2 years ago, I would have thought I knew the answer. No, I wouldn't even have asked the question.
Must have been hard on you growing up. I mean, you can't have got to see him much.
It wasn't really hard, Ed is cheerful. He was kind of around. He used to be there on holidays and stuff. He always came home at night.
He didn't, though. Ed was wrong. He didn't always come home at night.
Bristol, 2009. 6 days after. The phone was ringing as I woke. It was on Ted's side of the bed. I turned over to stretch across him, but my reaching hand hit the wall. Of course. Spare bed. Spare room. I heard Ted answer on the floor beneath me. His quiet, orderly cadences meant it was a call from the hospital. I heard him get up and go downstairs to make coffee. He had kept to the usual routine, though everything around him was different. He would be wondering why I hadn't slept next to him.
He would think it was because I had come to bed too late and didn't want to disturb him. He wouldn't know that I had hardly slept. That when I did, unspeakable nightmares had filled my mind. Nightmares that were still there when I woke. Thoughts so monstrous that I felt my head would burst open with them. Ted had lied. He hadn't been in the hospital the night Naomi disappeared. It was Ted who had taken her. Ted had picked her up from the theatre that night and had secretly taken her away. Why would he do that? The answer was there, ready-made. When he had seen her play Maria, he had realised she was someone different now, not his little Naomi, but another girl completely, grown up, sexy, challenging. Perhaps he didn't like that, so he had, what, raped her? Killed her! He would know how to. He would know precisely how to block the carotid artery or crush her trachea. I lay there, letting my darkest thoughts torture me until I felt sick and giddy with them. I knew there couldn't be any truth in them, but wasn't that what people always said when it turned out that the murderer was someone they loved? I walked down the flight of stairs from the spare room and sat on the edge of the empty double bed in our room. Ted's returning footsteps were slow on the stairs, and then he came in. He put my coffee on the bedside table.
Was I snoring again?
He leant to give me a kiss on the head, and then went into the bathroom without waiting for a reply.
A give-and-take moment that was not what it seemed.
There were probably clever ways of getting at the truth. Some trick I could play to catch him out. Pockets I could search, or a diary hidden somewhere. But I was too tired, too heartsick. I had to know quickly. Michael came round last night.
Yes?
His voice was thick with toothpaste. He wants you at the station this morning.
Well, that's not possible, I'm afraid. Why, anyway?
He shut the shower door, not waiting for the answer. I quickly put on what clothes came to hand. He looked surprised to see me dressed when he came out of the shower, toweling himself dry. He wrapped the towel tightly round his waist. His body was good for mid-40s, strong, slim and tightly muscled. I watched his face, still smooth from sleep. A face I've looked at for years, one that I thought I knew better than mine. They need you for questioning.
Sorry, Jen, you'll have to go.
He gave a little shrug as he reached into the wardrobe for a shirt.
No, I'm really busy today, back-to-back clinics.
He chose a red tie to go with the blue striped shirt.
I know it's bloody awful, but could you answer their questions for me?
For a second I wondered whether to wait, but I couldn't bear the surging nightmare anymore.
They want to know where you were on the night Naomi disappeared.
I wasn't sure if it was anger or fear that made it sound as if I was spitting these words at him. His face hardly altered. If anything, it became even smoother. Perhaps his mouth pulled down slightly, as though he had a little tick at one corner.
You know that already.
I didn't want to hear more lies, and I didn't want to look at him as he made them up. I got up and faced the window, looking out at the great entwined lime trees.
Where were you?
I told you at the time. I had a late operation. I turned to face him.
Your operation was cancelled. I checked.
There was silence. He went on dressing, taking his suit out of the cupboard, finding socks. I crossed the room and wrenched the suit out of his hands.
Where the fuck were you that night?
My voice was breathless.
Your daughter goes missing, and you're not where you said you were. What does that mean? What are the police going to think?
Suddenly his face became suffused with rage as he caught the echoes of my meaning.
What are you saying? He asked loudly.
I heard the boys begin to get up, and the thought of them, unsuspecting and sleepy, made it worse.
He lied to all of us.
Shut up, I whispered. Let the boys go to school. You have to go to the police station. They're coming to collect you. He stared angrily at me, his mouth set in a line.
They can arrest you if you refuse to go with them for questioning.
I didn't know if that was true. It could be. He paused, reached for the phone, and took it out of the room. I heard him cancelling his clinic. He had chosen to go to work 2 days after Naomi had disappeared, but now he had no choice. Ed left after a silent breakfast, and then Theo gathered his art portfolio slowly. He didn't want to go. Perhaps he saw through the pretense. When it was quiet, I faced Ted across the breakfast dishes. Okay, he muttered as though he was talking to himself. Okay. He looked up. I planned to tell you the day after it happened, but it was the night Naomi disappeared and I couldn't. In that second, the sick nightmare vanished. I knew what he was going to say, and I told myself it didn't matter at all. Compared to the torture of thinking he had hurt her, the fact he was going to tell me he had been unfaithful seemed insignificant. Tell me now. He looked around the kitchen quickly, as if seeing it for the first time. It was just once, that night. I made a stupid mistake. She's young, I mean, she's not married. I didn't care. I really didn't care. As I waited for him to continue, I understood in a flash why he had been so muddled about picking Naomi up. Everything about home had vanished from his mind that night. I was tired. I had missed lunch. My operation was cancelled, and Nitin took the slot for an emergency. I'd just finished a late round, and Beth was coming out of the ward at the same time. Beth. Beth in Little Women was the sweet one, generous, feminine. Everyone loved her. The sister on the neurosurgical ward. She saw I was exhausted. She said there was a restaurant near the hospital that was better than the canteen, but when we got there, it was closed, so I took her home. I thought how Beth would have a peaceful home. There would be no muddy rugby boots by the door, no messy dog jumping up. Together they would go over the shared drama of the day's work. There wouldn't be family questions to tussle with, the kind that had no easy answers, like how much homework the children should be doing or how late they could stay out. Beth would give him a glass of wine, turn on music, and dim the lights. She would sit close and listen to everything he said. She wouldn't be too tired for sex.
Why?
My voice didn't sound like mine. There was a long pause, and then he shrugged. I don't know whether it makes it better or worse, but there's no reason. She was there. He stopped, obviously wondering whether to continue in the face of my silence. Then, avoiding my eyes, he went on slowly, You and I, there's never time.
Say it. Never time for sex.
We're tired. We go to sleep.
Why can't you say what you mean?
But I knew what he meant. He was saying it was my fault. The phone rang. Ted answered it quickly.
Hi. Yes, my wife told me. I'm ready now. Ring and I'll come up.
He replaced the receiver and turned to me.
Michael's just parking. He's coming to collect me.
He squared his shoulders. I'm sorry, Jenny. I was going to tell you. He looked at me, and I could see him thinking that something else was needed.
I love you, you know that.
The bell rang. I sensed the full weight of anger and hurt holding off for the moment. There, but not real yet, like the beating edge of a migraine before the pain starts. He stood staring at me for moments longer. His skin was still brown from his recent trip to California. When we met old friends from medical school, they said he was ridiculously unchanged. Sometimes I thought I did the aging for both of us. I had seen the little wrinkles round my eyes appear and deepen, the blue veins flare round my ankles, but I thought that was fair exchange for what I had. I thought those kinds of changes didn't matter. I'm sorry, he repeated, as if saying it twice would make it better. We'll talk when I get back. Even then, I decided there was no point in talking. Excuses didn't alter anything. I didn't want to hear them anymore. I even let him kiss me goodbye. When he'd gone, Naomi's face filled my mind again. There was no room for anything else. 20. Dorset, 2010. 13 months later. Christmas Eve. In the morning, there are footsteps,
muffled laughter, then silence again. When Ted and I were young and newly together, love in the morning was warm and easy, no battles or bargains. How long ago was that? I hurry downstairs, not wanting to listen or remember. Bertie is curled and still in his basket. Suddenly afraid, my hands hover over him, checking if there is heat from his body, but taking care not to startle him awake, or he will struggle up quickly and look confused. In Bristol, I would clip on his lead when he was asleep, wake him, and take him out. He faithfully kept up as I jogged through the streets. He couldn't do that now. I leave him to sleep. More snow has fallen in the night. The twigs are outlined with a delicate ribboning of white. I lean my elbows on the windowsill to look at the new garden. Naomi used to long and long for a white Christmas, but I must push that thought away quickly before it fills the day. I have family to look after. There is a small wrapped parcel on the table. The paper is printed with trees and stars, and it has a brown label. I turn it over and it says, "To Jenny, from Sophie." My fingers pause. "No, Naomi, wait till Christmas Day, there's a good girl. Go to sleep." I unwrap the little parcel, tugging at the tape. Inside is a bundle of charcoal sticks, thick and slightly bumpy, wrapped in tissue tied with red wool. Effort and thought went into this. The framed pictures of Dan's and Mary's hands are leaning against the wall. I pick them up and go out of the cottage quietly. There is a new holly wreath pinned to Mary's door. She answers my knock quickly and looks relieved. Thought it was them lot already. She puts the kettle on. Her family